content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from theteenmagazine.com and teenvogue.com. Our first article today from teenvogue.com, Diet Culture History, From Ancient Greece to Ozempic. This article was written by Cameron Katz and Annie Elledge on January 25th, and there is a note. Weight Limit is a series that examines the rise of weight loss drugs like Wegovy and how they impact young people. In this installment, see the history of diet culture from ancient Greece to Ozempic. With a new year comes an opportunity to start fresh, and for some Americans, that means losing weight. According to a Forbes survey on New Year's resolutions, 48% of respondents reported they wanted to improve their fitness, 34% wanted to lose weight, and 32% wanted to improve their diet. Resolutions related to appearance and health outweighed several other wellness goals, such as spending time with loved ones, 25%, improving work-life balance, 7%, and meditating more regularly, 5%. In 2024, these resolutions have been bolstered by the emergence of quick weight loss drugs like Ozempic, a drug intended for adults with type 2 diabetes that has been harnessed for its weight loss side effects. Some celebrities have spoken openly about using Ozempic to lose weight, and the drug has exploded in popularity among the public. On TikTok, hashtag Ozempic has acquired 1.3 billion views, and hashtag Ozempic weight loss is catching up with 429.6 million views. Shortages of the drug are expected throughout 2024. Over the past few years, culture commentators have noticed a trend toward ultra-thinness among celebrities like Kim Kardashian, right on the heels of the slim, thick era of the 2010s, when BBLs and waist trainers reigned. This itself comes after the super-thin supermodel era of the 1990s, showing that weight and body size trends have always vacillated, and the history of dieting is rife with political, social, and economic influences. Dieting has existed for centuries, at least since ancient Greece, where dieting emerged as a holistic approach to physical and mental health. But the concept of dieting as primarily a way to lose weight or change one's body first appeared in the 19th century. Historians trace the contemporary Western relationship between dieting and weight loss to 1863, when English writer William Banting authored A Letter on Corpulence. However, Banting didn't have a background in health or medicine. His writing came from his own struggles with his weight. At age 64, Banting was 5 feet 5 inches and weighed 202 pounds. When he started to lose his hearing, Banting turned to surgeon William Harvey. Harvey had recently attended a lecture in Paris about the connection between the liver and diabetes, and had since been investigating how sugar, fats, and starches influenced the body. When a distressed Banting asked for solutions to weight loss, Harvey recommended that he cut out bread, butter, milk, sugar, beer, and potatoes, and to live on mainly animal protein, fruit, and non-starchy vegetables. About 9 months later, Banting had lost 35 pounds and his quality of life had significantly improved. He then self-published A Letter on Corpulence, detailing his journey, and gave copies away for free. Banting's published ideas primarily appealed to men who had traded work in the field for sedentary desk jobs thanks to industrialization. These men feared that their bodies were becoming too soft and feminine, and weight loss became a way to reclaim their masculinity. Banting indeed targeted A Letter on Corpulence to the growing white male middle class, who prized self-control education, and morality. On the other hand, the patriarchal society of the 1830s perceived women as emotional and lacking self-control, and therefore not built for the rigors of dieting. Beauty standards of the time also did not prioritize thinness. Rather, plumpness was associated with traits like wealth, motherhood, and sexual aptitude. It wasn't until the 1890s when diet advice began appearing in American women's magazines, when societal beauty standards around the female body were slowly shifting away from the dominant hourglass figure of the 19th century. The development of scientific racism, a pseudo-scientific approach used to prove the supposed superiority of the white race, partially relied on anti-fatness. Black women were characterized by presumed inability to control their consumptions. Not only did this shame black people and their bodies, but it also encouraged white women to begin dieting as a way to differentiate themselves from stereotypes of black women. Body size became another battleground for racialized and gendered ideals, and the Roaring Twenties pushed dieting into the spotlight. The ideal female body continued to evolve in the early 20th century. By the 1920s, following World War I, social activities that had once been overseen in the home, like dating, became public. New technology like movies and radio meant that trends could spread nationally, such as the flapper look for women. Flappers embraced a fiercely modern look, idealizing a thin, youthful, and flat-chested body type. They rejected rigid gender roles by wearing knee-length skirts, shockingly short for the time, cutting their hair, exposing skin, smoking in public, and attending jazz clubs. Suddenly, while plumpness had previously been associated with wealth and sexuality, thinness now reigned supreme. Only women who weren't desperate for food had the privilege of restricting their consumption for aesthetics, so the line of thinking went. As the demand for weight loss increased, so did the strategies to achieve this, like calorie counting, which had originated as a food rationing technique during World War I. In 1918, Dr. Lulu Hunt Peters, an American physician, popularized the concept of calorie counting for weight loss in her book, Diet and Health, with Key to the Calories. In wartime, it is a crime to hoard food, wrote Dr. Hunt Peters. Yet there are hundreds of thousands of individuals all over America who are hoarding food, stored away in their own anatomy. Dr. Peters's work characterized fat people as unpatriotic threats to the future of the United States. This perception linked weight loss to behaviors and values, just as often happened with race, gender, and class. The diet industry exploded after World War II. This was due, in part, to advancements in food and advertising technology, as well as increasing social, economic, and political pressures to conform to ideal standards of citizenship, femininity, and the nuclear family. At the time, the ideal American woman, as portrayed by pop culture, happily married a man, had children, and managed the suburban home. The image of the ideal American family relied on an idealized aesthetic of domesticity. Thus, housewives were particularly vulnerable to the diet industry, which often pushed new and more harmful tactics. American women began using new methods to diet, advanced by advertisers. For example, amphetamines, like benzedrine, which were originally used by soldiers to treat combat stress reaction, now known as PTSD, were increasingly marketed to women as diet pills. In 1967, one study found that patients at weight loss clinics spent $120 million on diet pills alone. Fad diets, including the grapefruit diet and the cabbage soup diet, also represented the desire for an easy dieting fix. In addition, brick-and-mortar dieting facilities began cropping up in the 1940s and 1950s. These facilities, often called reducing salons, had reducing machines designed to shape and slim one's body. One of the most famous diet programs in the U.S., Weight Watchers, now known as WW, began in Jean Neidich's living room in 1962 and launched the before and after photo phenomenon. Weight Watchers shifted dieting from a fad to a lifestyle change. Other programs, including Nutrisystem, founded in 1972, followed suit. During the 1960s in the U.S., widespread political and social shifts took place. From the civil rights movement to second-wave feminism and anti-Vietnam War protests. Amid this rejection of the status quo, the fat acceptance and fat liberation movements took root, addressing the social, political, and economic systems that create barriers for fat people. Fat liberationists contested anti-fat bias in employment and organized events such as the Fat Inn in Central Park. Fat black women formed the cornerstone of these movements. Margaret K. Bass wrote On Being a Fat Black Girl in a Fat-Hating Culture, 2011, to reflect on her experience growing up in the 1950s and 1960s. No one prepared me for living life as a fat person. Her account of harassment, bullying, and pressure to lose weight describes the struggles of living as a fat black girl living in an anti-fat world. Johnny Tillman, a social welfare activist, wrote, I'm a woman. I'm a black woman. I'm a poor woman. I'm a fat woman. I'm a middle-aged woman. And I'm on welfare. In this country, if you're any one of those things, you count less as a human being. If you're all those things, you don't count at all, except as a statistic. Despite the growing fat acceptance movements, dieting pressures grew in the 1970s and 80s. Exercise classes became increasingly popular for individuals hoping to slim down. American actress Jane Fonda starred in an at-home workout video that sold 17 million copies between 1982 and 1985. At the same time, diet foods became increasingly popular for American consumers. Lean Cuisine, created in 1981, and Diet Coke, created in 1982, offered low-fat, low-sugar, and low-calorie options. The accessibility of exercise options and diet foods made it much easier for the average American to participate in diet culture. In the 1990s and 2000s, an era of tabloids, paparazzi walks, and reality television provided Americans with myriad ways to observe, admire, and imitate the bodies of thin women. The waif and heroin chic aesthetics, popularized by British model Kate Moss, encouraged an androgynous and emaciated body as the beauty ideal. The hypervisibility of celebrities like Paris Hilton and Britney Spears opened up conversation about the size of these women's bodies. While these conversations certainly increased pressures to conform to a thin body type, this media landscape also increased awareness about eating disorders, particularly anorexia and bulimia. As some Americans became dissatisfied with pressures to diet and lose weight, they sought out new ways of viewing their bodies. Body positivity and body neutrality have grown in popularity over recent years. Additionally, fat study scholars have begun questioning the efficacy of some measures of health, such as the use of the Body Mass Index, BMI. Recently, fat activists won a major victory when New York Mayor Eric Adams banned discrimination based on weight in May 2023. Critics state that fat liberation movements are promoting unhealthy behaviors. In response, activists encourage people to understand anti-fatness as a system of oppression that negatively impacts one's physical, mental, and social well-being. While the pendulum is swinging back towards ideal thinness with the rise of Ozempic and other weight loss medications, fat liberationists are still working to destigmatize fatness and work towards a more equitable and just society for people of all body types. And there's an additional note. This article was produced with Made by Us, a coalition of more than 200 history museums working to connect with today's youth. Our next article from theteenmagazine.com. Why Education is No Longer About Learning. This article was written by Kosalya Kushik on January 27th. The night before a big exam or test, we're sitting there questioning our entire existence. We've fallen into the never-ending loop of assignments, followed by deadlines, followed by exams, and then it starts all over again. Am I improving? Am I developing? Is school about learning, or is it now about passing? Our attachment to grades. Our drive to learn is getting an A or having a perfect report card. While these motivations technically do steer us towards our bigger goal, they overshadow the main objective of the learning process. To learn. We are so obsessed with those tiny little letters that we forget the real reason we're in school in the first place is to expand our knowledge. We stuff our brains to the max with information that we forget a few days later anyways, just to get that A. To be realistic, this is how the system works, and if you don't follow it, you get left behind. But there's one thing we're forgetting. We need to learn and understand. We need to develop new perspectives, ideas, opinions, and thought processes, not just memorize just to get a decent grade. The test of our limits. Exams. Dun, dun, dun. You'd be lying if you've never cursed the person who invented this concept. According to Google, exams were invented in the late 1800s by an American businessman named Henry Fischel. Henry, the students send our love. It's not fair to say exams are completely inefficient. Technically, they measure your ability to remember the content you've learned. The problem is, that's all they do. Test your memory, not your understanding, or your problem-solving skills, or your critical thinking, or your creativity and innovation. They cause stress and anxiety before, during, and after. The seriousness of impending tests gives students the urge to cheat as they feel their self-worth or future is determined by how well they do on an exam. They don't test necessary practical skills, and in the process, completely deviate from the purpose of learning. Keep in mind that your mental ability is not based on how well you do on your exams. Focus on your all-around development so you can become a better person in every way possible. The generic curriculum. The curriculum that schools teach varies from country to country, so it's not possible to make a generalization. However, it seems like curriculums are way too generic at the school level. They force students to choose a specific set of subjects. It does not allow us to zero in on our strengths so we can excel at whatever we choose. Let's take an example. If you're good at biology, but also at accounts, there are very few combinations available that allows you to choose both. You often have to choose just one, which results in a combination of subjects which you are mostly uninterested in. In this case, education becomes a burden. You're not studying what you love, but rather being forced to study subjects that have zero appeal to you. This makes education lose its real value. Unhealthy competition. Healthy competition is good, but when millions of students compete for a single university spot or internship, it makes the end goal more important than your growth and learning. The pursuit of high marks to secure a spot can overshadow the deep understanding of subjects and practical skills. The curriculum narrows, which can lead to the neglect of so-called unimportant subjects. These subjects help expand knowledge and interests, but are sadly being sacrificed to win the race. Focus on beating the competition limits opportunities for personal growth, creativity, and the development of unique talents, which prevents us from exploring our individual passions and interests, and hence learning more. It's a business. Education is now a business, profit-driven and competitive. When education is a commodity, the focus shifts from learning to maximizing profits, which compromises the effectiveness of educational programs. Commercialization of education ends up focusing on immediate marketable abilities at the expense of long-term personal growth and a holistic education. Education's deeper goals, like expanding knowledge and gaining new perspectives, are ignored to meet the demands of the current job market. This limits creativity and innovative thinking. It's not about learning anymore. It's about finding a place in the generic mainstream of society. The skill gap. The skill gap occurs when the stuff taught in schools does not match the requirements of the work environment. As technology continues to advance, there is a growing gap between the skills students acquire in traditional educational settings and the technological skills demanded by the job market. Soft skills such as communication, critical thinking, problem solving, teamwork, and adaptability, which are more important than theoretical knowledge, are hardly taught. Things like financial literacy, social media literacy, self-defense, and decision-making, which are day-to-day use in the real world, are totally neglected. Students fail to learn the real knowledge that comes of real use to them. A better system. No system is flawless, but a few things every system can include to make it more accessible and useful are emphasis on practical and problem-solving skills. This helps students how to learn to apply things they have learned in real-life situations. Internships and community services can be useful. Change the exam system. Rather than standardized tests, tests should include a wider scope of skills like creativity, communication, and critical thinking so as to refocus the importance of education on learning. Redesign the curriculum. Students should be allowed to choose subjects based on their strengths and interests instead of generalizing them. The curriculum should also include creative, technological, and communication skill-based learning. Increased opportunities. More university spots and job openings can be opened up so that the intensity of competition decreases. Students are no longer caught up in the rat race of education and can genuinely learn and understand. In a nutshell, at the moment, education is hardly about learning. It's more about grades, exams, profits, and boring subjects than growing, developing, and expanding your thought processes and perspectives. It's not ideal at all. But unfortunately, we cannot overturn the system completely. What we can do is make some changes for a holistic and well-rounded education. Most importantly, keep in mind the real meaning of education. Try not to get too caught up in the frenzy of grades and exams, as education is so much more than any of those things. It's about learning and becoming a better individual. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Sophia Richie Grange is pregnant, expecting daughter with Elliot Grange. This article was written by Sam Reed on January 25th. And there is a note. This story originally appeared in Glamour. Sophia Ritchie Grange is going to be a mom. The 25-year-old shared the happy news in the most Sophia Ritchie Grange way possible, a photo shoot in Vogue. The images, shot by Yulia Gorbachenko, feature the mom-to-be posing in a series of very on-brand outfits. A pair of briefs and a crisp shirt unbuttoned at the belly, a long-sleeve backless black dress, a ribbed white tank and olive corduroy pants, a boxy black suit, sans bra or top. All in all, nothing too surprising from the woman who basically ushered in the era of stealth wealth fashion. Another photo captures Ritchie Grange and her husband of 9 months, Elliot Grange, both in matching breezy white looks. Also on brand, the way the couple told Grange's parents. We went to Elliot's parents, who live about 5 minutes away from us, and I think I had a box. I want to say it was a Hermes box or some sort of box, and I told everyone that I had bought them a gift from Milan Fashion Week, Ritchie Grange told Vogue. Everyone was like, "Ooh, Hermes." But then they opened it, and it had all three of the pregnancy tests in it. That's how we told all of our parents. Watching their reaction go from like, "I'm about to get an expensive present," to like, "I'm about to get a grandchild," was really sweet. Per Vogue, the couple had been casually trying for a child ever since they got married in April, and are thrilled to be expecting a little girl. She's growing pretty fast, so the due date is a bit up in the air, Ritchie Grange says. My dream in life is to have a daughter, and Elliot is really excited for a girl, too. I think it's so typical for boys to want boys, but he has a lot of sisters. It was really sweet. He's very sensitive. Sophia and Elliot began dating in 2021, got engaged in 2022, and then got married last spring in the wedding heard round TikTok. Now that she's entering her mom era, we assume the fervor will be just as loud. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.